The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Barbara Sabani. Barbara is the state director for the NASA's Colorado Space Grant Consortium, COSGC. Barbara manages the statewide COSGC higher ed affiliate network for space and aerospace projects and research. She directs and mentors student NASA projects at COSGC on the CU Boulder Boulder campus. Prior to COSGC, Barbara was Dean of Academic Affairs over the STEM disciplines, Honors Program Director, and Professor of Physics at Red Rock Community College. Her lifelong interest in life beyond Earth has led to working toward integrating unidentified anomalous phenomena research and curriculum. She is a MUFON board member and the managing editor of the MUFON Journal monthly publication. Her history with MUFON goes all the way back to birth, literally, as an infant at the picnic where the idea for then the Midwest UFO Network was conceptualized. John Schuessler, her father, was one of the founding members of MUFON, and it has played an important part in her family history. So, all that said, I'm honored to have her on the show today. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's great to have you. Now, for those in my audience who are unfamiliar with MUFON, please tell us what MUFON is.
Sure. So, MUFON, or the Mutual UFO Network, that is an organization that has indeed been around for over 50 years. And the goal of MUFON is to investigate sightings, UFO phenomenon, and investigate it in a scientific manner. And I think that's really the core of what makes MUFON stand out. And it was part of my dad's vision that UFOs be investigated using the scientific method and really dig in and look for evidence. And so, over the decades, that is indeed what MUFON has been doing.
Yes, very good. And help us with the recent nomenclature. We hear the term UFO and UAP in the same breath recently. What is the difference?
I've been thinking about that as well. UAP seems to be the buzzword or the buzz acronym these days. And I think the difference in trying to say aerial phenomenon versus a flying object, just it's a little bit more of a precise term. I mean, maybe you know, maybe we don't know exactly, are they flying? Are they coming in and out of a dimension? Are they, like, what are they doing? It is aerial phenomenon. But then there's also underwater phenomenon as well. So there, I think some of it, I don't know if you want to call it rebranding. I don't really think that's what it is. I think it's an effort to really hone in on what do these terms mean? I still find myself, I say UFOs all the time, because of course that is, you know, the term I've used all my life, pretty much.
Well, I think my audience knows when I say UAP, UFO, it's interchangeable.
Right.
I think. Some people are sticklers for that, though. You know, don't call them this, call them that. I get mixed up, so usually it's just UFO.
Yep.
What percentage of sightings reported to MUFON are explainable as conventional objects or natural phenomena?
You know, it varies by, if you look at the statistics of cases that have been completed in terms of being investigated and then given a determination. That really does vary quarter by quarter, but I would say, you know, on average, a majority of the reports are determined to be identified or, you know, in that sort of category. So It's a smaller percentage. I don't remember off the top of my head what the numbers were from the last quarter, but I could look that up. But yeah, case disposition, that's a pretty important component of doing investigation. It's one thing to just have a website where people can say, yep, this is what I saw, and I'm making a report. What makes MUFON a little bit different is that then those reports get taken and investigated. And then it's really that investigation that starts to dig into what did folks see? What did they experience? And is it something that we can explain? And maybe it isn't. But until you start to look and help, you know, work through that case, it's, you know, it's undetermined at that point still. So it's a really important process to follow.
What is the process you follow when you get a report? Move on.
That's a great question. So reports come in through the reporting network. I would say the majority of our reports do come in through our through the internet. And then the way that MUFON is organized is each state has a director, and then the director receives that report if it's in his or her state. And then the director for the state determines, you know, in terms of their field investigators that they have available, they assign cases to their field investigators. And then the field investigators, you know, do the legwork of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And then all of that, there's a reporting process, of course, and documentation of any evidence for the case. And then all of that gets compiled in a reporting system within MUFON.
Mm-hmm. And then what? What do they do about this?
Well, a lot of it depends. It depends. Is this a, you know, a one-off, I saw something in the sky for a couple minutes sort of report, or is it something much more in depth? And if it's something that's a much more in-depth case, then, you know, it is likely to be investigated over a period of time. And then is it something where the people involved need help? Do they need medical care? Do they need, you know, all those sorts of things? Now, you know, MUFON investigators don't do that part, mm-hmm. but, you know, if they can help connect witnesses with, you know, the services that they might need, of course, and then, you know, that would be part of a follow-up.
Okay. So basically, it's gathering information and keeping a database, so you can correlate this sighting with that report and put them together.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. So, you know, if there's a significant sighting and it's reported from, say, you know, multiple states, and you have multiple witnesses, then the fact that you have this reporting system and this way of really holding on to information, you know, that allows you to do a bigger investigation if it's starting to look like sightings are connected, or you know, maybe one object was reported by many people. So by having and maintaining this database, that allows not only research and investigation that's happening real time, but then also historic investigations and looking back at cases and seeing if you can connect the dots between sightings.
Yeah. I asked previously about how many are explainable conventional objects and natural phenomena. And I believe it varies, depends on who you ask.
Right.
It's like 85 to 90%. I've even heard as high as 95% are explainable in earthly terms. But it's that 5 to 10% that MUFON's interested in. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it also depends kind of on the amount of time that you're looking at. You know, are you looking at a year's time, 10 years time, 100 years time? You know, that's where, you know, that's where you can really start to get in some interesting information. Just looking back at, I was able to pull up some numbers here from some historic data. It is looking like just U.S. cases in the database, about 34% are listed as unknown. So that means that's a pretty good chunk.
Yeah.
And then say, like, from the fourth quarter of last year, 29% of cases were listed as unknown. So the other categories that can be determinations are identified object, mm-hmm. hoax, a case with insufficient data, and then an information only case. So that might be something where they, you know, they're, for whatever reason, there was not a follow-up investigation, either, you know, somebody just reported it online and they weren't interested in doing anything else with it. Mm-hmm. That's where an information-only case can be. So those you can't really put into those other buckets because you can't do the follow-up. But yeah. So if you think about those other cases where, you know, 10 to 15%, you know, you're just not able to do further investigation, you know, that changes those numbers too. Then internationally, if you look at international cases for the last quarter of last year, 27% were listed as unknown.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage do you think are actually hoaxes?
You know, as far as the case numbers in the database, very few. For looking at those last quarter numbers, only 3%. Of mm-hmm. cases were listed as determination as a hoax.
Yeah.
So that's very small comparatively.
And but you're able to, I mean, MUFON is able to identify these hoaxes.
Right. I mean, of course, these are reports where the investigation was completed and a determination was made. So, you know, I don't know all of the details of those 3% of cases that were determined to be hoaxes, but, you know, that could be through photo analysis, video analysis, mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing.
And approximately how many reports did you receive, did MUFON receive last year? Let's say, for example, last year.
You know, I don't have the numbers for the whole year. But again, just to give you a ballpark, so I have those fourth quarter numbers here in front of me, almost 1,000 cases in the U.S. And another a little over 100 international. And that's just in the fourth quarter. So, you know, that gives you an idea of the reporting rate.
Yeah. So, and a good chunk of those, say 10%, are unidentified. You know, people say, well, MUFON people say that these are aliens from another planet. And we really don't say that, do we? We say they're unidentified.
Correct.
That's let right. your mind run where it wants, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, because if you're thinking about just dealing with the facts at hand, you know, if you could, you can rule out, okay, it's not this, it's not this, you know, it's none of the things that we can identify. That's as far as you can get, you know? So that's why the determination is once you get to that level and then you say it is unidentified. So it is something we are not able to, you know, put a name to.
I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell, and this is We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with Ms. Barbara Sabani, MUFON editor of National MUFON Journal, amongst many other things. It has so many letters in them, I'm not even going into it, but highly impressive, highly impressive. It's not some slub you get off the street saying, oh yeah, there's a UFO up there.
You know, that reminds me of something that I think probably a lot of folks who are in the UFO investigation world run into is, you know, in very few people do this full time, right? So, you know, the work that I do with MUFON is not my full time job. You know, my full time job is as a, you know, researcher and educator. But when you talk to folks about UFOs and investigating UFOs, you know, a lot of times there is that sort of giggle factor that happens, like, oh, you know, yeah, those little green men, is that what you're doing? And interestingly, though, I would say over the last maybe 10 years of my career, I get a lot less of that. You know, instead, I get, hey, that's really interesting. You know, tell me more about that. What is MUFON? What is that? And I think it's because there is a shift in perception, I think. And I'm kind of coming at it from sort of the scientific academic world. I mean, clearly it's not all resolved. But I think folks are a lot more open to talking about this as a topic, looking at it as a topic. One of the things that I did while I was still at my previous institution, is I helped develop an undergraduate course on astrobiology. And we were looking for, you know, ideas for courses that would be broadly attractive to a wide range of students, sort of to get them interested in science. And I'm like, hey, what about life beyond Earth? How about that as a topic? And everybody's, well, okay, you know, let's see what that looks like. So, you know, I developed and taught a course for actually many years about the search for life beyond Earth. And one of my favorite assignments that I put in that course that I had students do is I had students choose historic or, you know, famous UFO cases. And they had to dig in to the investigation, and they had to do a report on those cases and in the context of scientific investigation, and like what kind of conclusions are you able to make based on researching this event. So I think it's things like that where you start to embed these ideas and these topics in ways that makes them approachable and lets people see them maybe with a little bit different lens.
Have you ever had debates amongst your students?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, teaching that class, one of the things that we did, and we in the very first week, is we had a debate and discussion around kind of where are people coming at this topic. And then I had the students go out and give a survey on campus, just a quick 2-question survey. One, do you believe there's life beyond the earth in the universe? And if the answer was yes, then they got the second question, which it was, do you believe there is intelligent life beyond earth? And in terms of responses, over 80% of the people that the students asked over, and this is cumulative over many years of running this class, over 80% of people had a yes to the intelligent life beyond earth question. Mm-hmm. And even higher percentage said, yes, I think there's life out there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Here's an interesting item. Maybe you've already done it, but if not, I'll put a bug in your ear here. Pick a student that, or students that do not believe in the UFO phenomena, and then some that do believe in the UFO phenomena, and just some, okay, you believe in the, there are UFOs, okay? Now I want you to take the opposite view. Study mm-hmm. up on it and make an argument that there is no life on other planets, and vice versa with the other students. And it would be fun just to see these skeptics go out there and study, because they have to study for this debate.
Absolutely.
And they go out and study and see how many of them come back with, you know, I didn't believe in this before, but now that I studied it.
Well, and, you know, that actually happened quite a bit throughout the years teaching that course. Oh. The UFO report assignment came at the end of the semester. It was one of their final things that they did. And, you know, we spent a lot of time during the semester talking about all of the different, you know, scientific disciplines, how they feed into, you know, looking for life beyond Earth, probabilities, you know, what do we know about biology and extreme life on Earth and all of these things. So, you know, they spent all of this time really digging into all this information. Mm-hmm. And then at the end is when I asked them to kind of, okay, now let's start with a case. And many of the students, even if they're like, okay, I think there's life out there, they're still not on board with that, you know, UFOs are visiting Earth mm-hmm. necessarily. But that was exactly why I had them do that research project. And it was always interesting. And quite a few students, because they would have to also give an oral presentation to the class about the cases that they investigated. And investigated is a strong word, that they researched, I should say.
Yeah.
Right. You know, quite a few of them said, you know, wow, this was not what I expected
right.
when I started this project.
Right.
Yep.
That's good. So my suggestion has been taken already.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I don't get credit. I don't get credit for this.
Oh, you, of course you do.
I don't believe you, Barbara. Anyway. And I didn't come on the MUFON scene until the late 90s. But as I understand it, when MUFON began, the organization didn't want to touch the entity or abduction angle of the phenomenon. And when did that change?
You know, that is true. The original, you know, sort of mission of MUFON, and as it started, the Midwest UFO Network, was to look at things from a technical, you know, scientific technical aspect, really, you know, trying to get a handle on, okay, based on sightings, are we able to tell anything about the the technology that's visiting, you know, mm-hmm. and that was really the emphasis for quite a long time. And I think it was as the discipline sort of that's associated with looking at, the experience or perspective. I think there were some really key researchers involved, including Dr. Leo Sprinkle. And I think a lot of that work that was happening, and that was happening alongside MUFON, not necessarily within MUFON per se, mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a pretty tight-knit research community. And I think there really started to be more dialogue about, you know, okay, well, how do we research, you know, cases that involved potentially abductions and things like that. Like that was something that had to be really dug into. And then how do you adapt the investigation protocols to be able to include that? Because even in the early 80s, there still weren't really protocols for investigators to look at medical evidence or report medical evidence like that. The investigator training and then the tools that are available to the investigators in MUFON have really evolved quite a bit since the early 80s. An interesting side note, one of my early jobs, I will use that term loosely, was to edit one of the early versions of the field investigator manual. This is back in the early when we used to have a, you know, paper copy of the investigator's manual, and that's all it was. And then the early digital versions, I got to edit one of those. When I think about it, I've been editing for MUFON for a really long time.
I guess. Very good. And you ever write articles for the MUFON Journal?
I do. I have an occasional column. It's called SciNote. And usually it's when if there's been a scientific discovery or you know, a space mission that's relevant to topics that are related to life beyond Earth or searching for life beyond Earth or things like that. That's the focus of the column that I write. It's not in there every month. We usually publish a couple a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So teaching astrobiology at a college level, tell our listeners about some of the experiments you have your students involved with.
So in terms of that course, it's not a lab-based course, so they're not doing lab work, but they do quite a bit in terms of learning the baseline information that you need to understand about, one, what makes something alive. So if we're trying to classify life beyond Earth, we have to have a really good understanding of what we mean by life, because life beyond Earth is probably not going to be exactly like life here. In fact, it would be a little odd if it was, because how life developed on Earth is also an important context. So you really have to understand a little bit about chemistry, a little bit about physics, about geology, all of those things in addition to biology. Because mm-hmm. though all of those disciplines really feed into, mm-hmm. One, how life got going on Earth and what that means, and then how life can actually, in what kinds of environments can life thrive. So something that I've worked with students on and still do actually is having students do experiments outside the classroom, and one of the platforms that we use is high altitude ballooning. So students can design experiments that will be put into payloads that then go on a high altitude balloon. And one of the reasons you might want to do that is because high altitude balloons can get up to 100,000 feet and will be exposed to, you know, the very low pressure, very cold temperatures of that high altitude, you know, in the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. And they get exposure to that for, you know, usually a little over an hour for the kind of balloons that we use. And you can do experiments, particularly some microbial experiments on, you know, how do certain types of life respond to those extreme environments? And, you know, what does that tell you about life? And students are just, they're fascinated by these questions. And it's really exciting to be able to give them a way to do, you know, field testing of some of these. Yeah.
Sounds like an exciting experiment. What is the takeaway from those experiments, or that particular experiment?
So there actually have been quite a few that have been done. Some using different types of microbial life. Some that have been actually done a couple times was exposing different varieties of yeast. And then utilizing those yeast in even a brewing type process. Like, does the exposure to those extreme environments change how the yeast activates in a chemical reaction? And the answer is yes, it does. So, you know, you take batches of yeast that have been exposed to near space. And then you compare them, you do the same process with yeast that has obviously not, you keep it down here on the ground. And then you look at the different chemical reactions in the yeast activation process and see, are there significant changes? And the answer is yes. So that then led students to think, well, okay, if it's doing this to yeast, what about microbes? What about, you know, lichens? What about all, you know, what about all these other little things? Because of course we're not sending, you know, mammals or anything up in these little balloons, because that would that would not work out so well. You know,
it gets awfully cold, wouldn't it?
It gets very cold, -40 degrees Fahrenheit. So yeah, that and very low pressure atmosphere. So not so good, but all of these other types of organisms, it's a great platform to test viability. And, you know, there is a whole space biology community of researchers out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of that research is focused on, you know, future human settlement off planet, particularly with the new emphasis of going back to the moon to stay. There's quite a bit of research happening on, all right, so what about long duration exposure to lunar dust? What about, you know, long duration exposure to, you know, the lunar radiation environment and things like that? So all of those things are really valuable questions to look at. But each time you do experiments like that, you are learning about what the impact of the space environment is on all different kinds of life. So, you know, I find it fascinating. Students find it fascinating. It's a neat time to be doing space research.
So you send these balloons up, your students send these balloons up.
Mm-hmm.
How do they retrieve them with all the data?
That is a great question. So the platform that we use, you have the actual research balloon. It's like a weather balloon, maybe a little bit bigger. And there is a transceiver payload. So the transceiver payload actually has the capability to send out and receive radio signal. And then you have a tracking frequency. Okay. So when you, there's also excellent software available to do a trajectory map of, you know, based on, okay, we're going to launch from this location at this time. The modeling of what the flight path is going to be for that balloon, even days ahead of time, is amazingly accurate these days. The software that's out there to do this kind of modeling is really, really impressive. So often we know within, you know, a pretty good margin, okay, this is the projected flight path. So we know that we need to station people, you know, and sometimes it's, you know, we're releasing the balloon in northeastern Colorado, and it might be projected to go almost to the Kansas border. And then sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it'll just loop right back around and land almost, you know, pretty close to where we launched. Yeah. Uh-huh. So basically what happens is, you know, that you fill the balloon, you let it go. And then as it rises up in the atmosphere, the balloon expands. And then, of course, it finally gets to a point. And it's usually, like I said, around 100,000 feet, maybe 120,000 feet max. And then the balloon will burst. And then balloon burst, and then it's going to head back down. And then, of course, you're getting those pings back from the payload, so you're able to track it as well. And you can see, and this is pretty cool. There's the students can download an app on their phone that lets them actually watch those packets of information coming back from the balloon, so they can see in real time the change in altitude of the balloon. So they can see when it's coming back down and kind of where it's projected to land. And then we go and retrieve it. Part of that, of course, is depending on where it lands. If it lands on private property, we have to wait and get permission to, of course, enter the private property in order to retrieve the payloads. We work with a group here in Colorado called Edge of Space Sciences, and they are a mostly volunteer group of folks who do this kind of radio tracking, and they're just fabulous. And they do all our permitting, because you have to do permitting and everything for when you're doing a launch. Yeah. So they take care of all that for us. But then the students are involved, you know, from liftoff, and then we do the chase part, which is a lot of fun. Which is basically you're driving along the path and kind of waiting to see where it's going to go. And then retrieval is sort of the, okay, did our experiment survive? We've had great luck. We've been able to retrieve every flight string that we have ever launched.
Very good. Very good. Yep. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. And this is We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with MUFON journal editor and many, many other letters behind her name, Mrs. Barbara Savani. Okay, so we were talking about where these, if these beings are visiting us, where they're coming from. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the panspermia theory.
Yep.
Do you subscribe to that theory?
You know, I think there's a lot of really interesting evidence for that. I don't know, I'm not an expert in that area, so I don't know if I could make a full determination, but I think there's a lot of interesting evidence pointing to that as a possibility. Mm-hmm. Some of the more recent discoveries of, you know, all of the different building blocks of life, all of the components that we have been able to identify out, you know, beyond the solar system, out in the galaxy, knowing that those things are abundant, you know, I think it's highly likely that, you know, early in Earth's development, you know, we were, and maybe it was during the heavy bombardment period of when the solar system was being formed, you know, maybe that was the time when life, at least the building blocks of life for sure, but, you know, maybe even other life forms were, you know, were distributed here. Mm-hmm. There was a really interesting, an interesting study that was done, I believe it was on a meteorite, and, you know, looking at the potential survivability rate of, all right, if you had something that was alive, you know, what would that survivability rate be of something entering the atmosphere and, you know, landing on Earth and things like that. So, I mean, those are questions that I think are totally worth looking at, because the more information we have about that sort of thing, the more we can, you know, make a pretty good estimation of what was possible, since obviously we were not there to see what happened. I think it's definitely probable.
Maybe we were there. We just didn't realize.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly.
We're able to put two and two together. But it seems logical. You take flowers when they go to seed and get those flowers, and it spreads and it magically grows elsewhere.
Yep.
So, why not that way with asteroids, planets, whatever?
Right. Right. And, you know, if you've got a planet that has life on it, say, and it gets hit by, you know, meteorites or, you know, cometary fragments or whatever, and it blasts off pieces back out into space and creates new meteorites, and those go and those land in other parts of the solar system, you know, it's viable in terms of it can happen. And, you know, the more we know about the survivability of life, and that's where studying extremophiles here on Earth, that gives us a lot of information about that. You know, like it's basically gotten to the point that if there's a place on Earth that is a crazy environment, we have found life there. You know, I mean, there's life that can live in extreme radiation environments, and in fact require those extreme radiation environments to live. So it's pretty interesting. And it's changed the perspective of, you know, we used to think, oh, life is so fragile. It's not as fragile as we think.
No. Yeah, we didn't think that there was any life down where the Titanic at the bottom of 2 miles down.
You know? Right.
No sunshine. Water pressure is like 2 tons per square inch. Yeah,
yep.
Just couldn't be. Life
was
right. Now we find out we were wrong.
Well, you know, it was assumed you had to have sunlight. You know, the photosynthetic cycle was the only way that we knew that kind of life exchange could happen. And now we know there's a whole chemosynthetic cycle that sunlight has nothing to do with. And you're right, it's some of the deep sea experiments and some of those really deep sea submarine, you know, and remote little vehicles that we've sent down, even, you know, down in like the Marianas Trench and things. And there's life down there.
That's 7 miles deep.
Yeah. I mean, and there's life down there. So, yeah.
Yeah. I like to say that all we know is all we know and nothing more.
Yep. I like that.
Yeah. So, has MUFON been privy to any of the nuts and bolts or biological evidence like David Grush has alluded to under oath at the congressional hearing?
You know, that is actually a really exciting development for MUFON. Over the last several years, MUFON has been investing in a new lab that it has the capability of doing lots of different types of biological testing of samples, of evidence, of tissues, of all sorts of things. So it's a newer capability that MUFON has, that we have our own lab, our own folks in-house that are able to do that type of investigation. And so I would say, you know, some of the first reports are coming out of the lab. And so the answer is yes, MUFON has been able to look at that, but it's definitely a newer capability in terms of being able to do it all within MUFON. Prior, MUFON would have to, you know, if there were samples that needed to be looked at, they would have to find an external lab that was willing to do analysis, you know, and follow protocols and all of that. And now MUFON has the capability to do that themselves, which is a huge step forward and will actually allow a lot more of that type of evidence to be investigated, which is really exciting.
So what have we found, or is that a secret?
I would say it's not a secret. I just don't personally have the accounts.
They don't even share it with you.
Well, they absolutely would. It's just I haven't read them. It doesn't. although, but some of that, because it's taken a bit to get the lab up and running. And actually, we're still in the process of adding new lab equipment particularly for any type of genetic testing to be done. We have some equipment in the lab that allows some level of genetic testing, but we've been adding some new equipment that will allow us to do more. Some of those first lab reports, they are coming out, and MUFON researchers will be publishing those results in upcoming articles and upcoming talks. So again, it's not secret. It's just pretty new.
So the Reader's Digest answer there is yes, we do have some evidence
yes.
to show that these, you say biological, yep. Is that entities?
Well, at least... At least biological indications of definitely indications, depending on the case, some cases where there's definite confirmation of damage, tissue damage from, from perhaps probably radiation exposure related, but, some in that realm, as well as looking at, what about the composition of materials that are recovered from, investigation sites? And is there any biological component to that? Like all of those things are now things that we are able to actually test in the lab.
Yeah. So in other words, the old excuse, we don't have, where's the evidence? There's mm-hmm. no evidence. Well, that can be shot down because MUFON has some evidence, if not all.
Right, right. And there's been evidence all along,
yeah.
really. But I think some folks, the bar for their evidence is different than others. I would say there's some really significant cases that have had loads of evidence that. Definitely that something happened. Definitely something happened to people. And other types of trace evidence. There's a lot of really strong cases out there. It's whether or not folks look at the evidence, and see for themselves. Like, mm-hmm. yep, here these are the reports. Here is how it was investigated. Of course, the case that I'm most involved in and most familiar with is the Cash Landrum case, from 1980, and that's the case where the witnesses to the witnesses of a craft, all three of them received pretty severe
radiation
and biological harm following. That followed their encounter, and there's so much documented evidence of what happened with them, yet folks will still say nope, there's no evidence.
They refuse to, none so blind as those yeah. refuse to see, right?
Right, right.
And in fact, there's been a lot of compelling cases in antiquity. But since you've been on the MUFON board of directors, what stands out to you as one of the most compelling cases?
Ooh, it's hard to narrow that down, really. Clearly some of the historic cases really stand out to me, of course, in addition to Cash Landrum, but, the Rendlesham case and of course, Roswell. Some of those really foundational investigations,
mm-hmm.
and I think one of the reasons that those stand out to me is the number of investigators now that have really dug into looking for historical evidence, looking for corroborating, reports, other types of things. It's the cases that have physical evidence, biological evidence, like those are the ones that really stick with me. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm discounting other ones. It's just from, kind of like from that scientist standpoint, those are the ones that like, all right, there's really something there, that we really need to be digging into. There of course are some really good recent cases as well, but it's hard for me to pick one. I don't know that I can play favorites.
Well, let's say just recently that been reported in the MUFON Journal. Mm-hmm. Give us an example from that.
Well, actually, there's in the last couple months, we've received quite a few international cases that have really a load of great both photographic and physical evidence. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of one maybe that stands out. Hard to say. I should have picked one ahead of time.
I should have given you a warning, huh?
That's right. That's right. Oh yeah. Putting together the journal every month is always a pleasure. We have a few regular columnists in the journal, but really the bulk of what we publish every month is submissions from MUFON investigators, MUFON state directors, and folks who are out there doing the investigating. That's the majority of what we try to publish. Mm-hmm. To give folks a glimpse of what's going on. I wish we could be publishing a 50-page journal every month, because there's so much happening, but we have to boil it down just a bit.
Yeah. I had one article published in the journal way back mm-hmm. when about a UFO / is it a blimp? Is it a UFO? The Coppola was on top of the quote unquote blimp, which makes no sense.
That makes no sense. That's correct. there's been some really interesting, airship type cases, and even some of historical, different historical sightings and really early ones that were sort of, that was really the only thing that was flying. So of course, if it's in the air, it must be, an airship or a balloon of some sort or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, I recently have started to go back and pull some early historic writings around that just to take a look. I'm fascinated by that. Because of course you go back to times when the stuff that was flying was definitely not ours, because we didn't even have anything then. So,
Yeah. And even today, a congressman said they're either Chinese, Russian, or other. And well, mm-hmm. they're not Chinese or Russian, because you got that kind of technology, I don't want to deal with them.
Yeah, absolutely. The technology development angle of this, also really fascinating to dig into. If you're going from what is observed and what is captured on video of these objects and what they're doing and how they're doing it, that points to some pretty serious technology and advancements for sure.
So in your opinion, has UFO disclosure already happened?
I'd say yes and no.
That covers it.
There you go.
That's safe.
I do actually think that there have been bits of disclosure happening all along. I don't think in my opinion, there has not been one watershed disclosure moment yet. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's a trend towards disclosure. Do I think everything's ever going to be disclosed, like all of it? I think no, but that's just my personal opinion.
How do you judge, for example, David Grush's testimony? If he's lying to Congress, then we should know that.
I'm certainly not saying he's lying to Congress. I think the congressional hearings are a great step forward, actually. Mm-hmm. And giving a real platform for discussion of these things at the congressional level is huge. I think that's probably one of the bigger steps towards disclosure that I think we have made. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to see where that goes over the next year or so. If it goes anywhere, maybe. I think there's a lot going on politically right now, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Mm-hmm. And even just the, some of the other sort of big trending things, I would say, that are out there, you know, the whole Skinwalker Ranch phenomenon. Oh, yeah. that's gaining so much attention, and obviously gaining resources in terms of investigation. Mm-hmm. You know, the amount of technology that they are utilizing to do mm-hmm. investigation out at Skinwalker is really impressive.
Millions and billions, I think.
But you know, as a scientist, like, that is exactly how I would be investigating that site.
Right.
You know, if I were the scientist in charge, that is what I would be doing. Absolutely. Right. You know, because you're gathering really critical data. So the more we can be doing investigations like that, the better.
Right. That is right. Well, they're branching off now into beyond Skinwalker. And right. It's become very compelling evidence.
Yeah.
So absolutely. If our listeners want to get involved with MUFON, where should they go to do so?
You can head right to the MUFON website. And there's ways to get involved. There's, of course, you can become a MUFON member. If you just want to poke around in the MUFON website a little bit and get familiar, that's, of course, an option as well. But if you're a MUFON member, you do get access to the monthly journal. So, of course, I have to push that a little bit because sure. I'm proud of our monthly journal. I think it's been, you know, it's been a longstanding publication. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, MUFON has its annual symposium every year. Actually, we're coming up on the next one in July. And the proceedings of these symposia are also available. And you don't have to be a member to purchase those. And so it's basically a book that gets published every year of the papers that are presented at the MUFON symposium. So it's another way to kind of just dig in a little bit and learn a little bit more.
You can also become an investigator, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you're interested in getting out there in the field and doing investigating, then MUFON has a whole field investigator training program. Mm-hmm. And you too can be investigating UFO sightings in your state.
Very good. Barbara Savani, I want to thank you so much for joining us on We Are Not Alone. And I hope we can discuss this further at another time.
That would be great. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you for coming on. Have a good one.
Thanks.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.